So I usually come to talk about my own research when I'm here. The research coming out of my lab, so I'm usually at Carnegie Mellon Institute, and then I work at Carnegie Mellon University, and then I visit the Santa Fe Institute in the summer. If you're looking to make a career shift, I recommend the Santa Fe Institute Summer School, which is a lovely place to learn and collaborate with people who work in complex systems. I'm not going to talk about my research today. If you don't want me to talk about my research today, you should ask lots of questions. I think that's the best way to do it. But I'm going to give you a small bit of game theory, and then I'm going to talk primarily about the last five centuries of collaboration and research in science. And I'm going to begin with a quote by Benjamin Franklin. He was not talking about science, but he was certainly, and he was talking about the American Republic, which was just beginning to be put together in the writing of the Constitution. "We must hang together, or we shall surely hang separately." In order to do science, we don't just need computers and education. We also need to work together. And working together is not just about sort of emailing each other, getting data analysis, getting help with a particular technical question, or even writing papers together. We need to know what other people are doing so we can compete. We need to know what other people are doing so that we can structure our own research so that we're trying to answer the same kinds of questions using the same kinds of methods. Group or department back at Carnegie Mellon University has we're sort of a combination of psychologists and people in economics. And people in economics are sort of like physicists. So what they do is essentially 5 years after the psychologists have discovered something, they redo everything and publish it in an economics journal. And of course, it's incredibly frustrating for the psychologists because it's a huge duplication of research. In general, we don't want to do that. We want to focus our attention. And in fact, we're even willing to sacrifice to do that. If I think that the majority of people are going to be using a suboptimal method, as long as I don't think it's too bad, I'm going to use it as well. So what happens, or how do we understand these large-scale collaborations looking sort of in the same direction? So this is the game theory story. Does anybody here know Rousseau's stag hunt? Has anybody seen it? Okay, very good. Yeah, I see you have failed in the Rousseau stag hunt maybe once or twice. So the stag hunt, you don't really need any game theory to understand it. It's an M-player game, so there's, you know, let's say 100 people, and there's two possibilities. You're hungry, okay? All of these people can go off separately and go catch a rabbit, okay? Go catch a rabbit. And if you catch a rabbit, oh, it's fine, okay, you eat a rabbit for the day. But what you really want is to catch a stag. You really want to catch, like, a big animal. The problem with catching a big animal, at least in this story, and this comes, of course, from Jean-Jacques Rousseau, right? The problem with hunting a big animal is that everybody has to go in, because the story is you're going to have to circle the animal. If anybody doesn't go in, the stag will go through the gap, and you've lost it, and then you go hungry, okay? This is a story, it's a funny story. I know you're at Leipzig, right? So there's the people who talk about the origin of sociality. This is an interesting story because it locates the beginning of civilization, the beginning of large-scale collaboration, not in the desire to cooperate, not in altruism, not in ideas that we have to somehow promote people helping each other, which it turns out we do naturally. The difficulty with civilization, the difficulty with getting people to go and hunt a stag, is the problem of knowledge. It's the problem of other minds. So let's say we all want to go hunt a stag, and let's say just for the sake of it, we can't talk to each other. We haven't flown in from New Zealand. We haven't actually, you know, burned all that carbon to get here, right? And let's say, you know, we're all into this, right? So, you know, I may want to hunt the stag. I'm willing to take that risk. But do I show up in the forest that morning with my stag hunting gear, with my bow and arrow? I may not, because I may not know that you guys are willing to do it. So I might be the only person out there. But it's even worse, right? Because say I'm willing, and say, in fact, I know all of you guys are willing. I have some reason to believe that. I still won't go, because I don't know if you know that same fact about everybody else. So you'll be sitting there being like, I'd really like to do this project. I'd really like to burn some time in order to do this. But does everybody else know that I'm willing to burn that time? And you can see where this is going, right? This is some kind of recursive problem here where, you know, I want to hunt the stag, you need that, but I also need, if I'm Jack, I need Jill to know that I want to hunt the stag, right? And Jill needs to have me knowing that she knows that I know, right? We call this level K thinking. Ooh, my animation's not perfect here, right? Level zero is I know something, Level one is I know that you know something. Level two is I know that you know that I know. This is like Lisp, right? There's too many parentheses showing up here, right? Level three is I know that I know that you know, right? Building common knowledge is not easy. And in fact, you can show that if you want to reach, if you want to get from the rabbit equilibrium, where we don't believe we're all going to show up, for some reason we think it's not going to happen, and we want to get to the stag equilibrium, we actually have to get to level infinity, okay? I'm willing to hunt the stag level zero, I'm willing, and I know that you are willing, okay? But then the problem is, do you know that I know that, right? I am willing, I know you're willing, I know you know I'm willing, but do you know that I know, right? And so the backwards induction, okay, obviously this is the fun part, right? You know, if I'm at level n, I think you're at level n minus one, which means you think I am at level n minus two, which means you think I think you're level, at some point you're gonna bottom out, some image of somebody's gonna be level zero, they're not gonna hunt, and then it propagates through, and in fact, we're not gonna do it. How deep do we actually go? People have done studies on this. We know in the stock market, basically we're usually somewhere between level one and level two, right? We know that like other people may or may not know something about us when we sign a contract, and maybe we get a little bit further up and we talk about other people's knowledge of that fact. You can test this, and I test this with a group with a game called the two-thirds game. So everyone picks a number between zero and 100 in this room, right? And the goal, the winner, is the person who gets closest to two-thirds of the average, okay? So you gotta figure out what everybody else is going to think the average is, then you just go one level deeper and you take two-thirds of that, okay? So, you know, one way to do this is, let's say people are just guessing at random, they're just kind of goofing off, right? They're not paying attention in class, so they guess randomly. That means the average is gonna be 50, so if you think everybody else is at level zero, you just go to level one and then you pick 33 and you win. Then you say, wait a second, right? Because everybody thinks everybody else is a moron. So they're gonna go to level one, and so you just get one step ahead and you're level two, right? And then you're like, eh, right? So you take another step. Of course, by the way, level infinity in this case, what's the level infinity answer? What's the common knowledge winning move here? Zero, right? So of course, nobody picks zero. The game theorists will tell you like zero is the rational point to be, right? But if you think people are somewhat moronic, right? If you think they have some limited ability, you're not gonna do that. So I've done this with CMU undergraduates. The actual average is somewhere around level two, and so you get this winning guess if you go to level three. I used to teach at Indiana University, and they're sort of between level one and level two. Okay. I'll tell you one story since some of us are going to fly home. A friend of mine studied something called the TCAS system. TCAS system is when you have, this is very rare, but if two passenger jets are expected to collide or to come within some danger radius of each other, this ancient device sitting in the nose cone of every passenger jet called the TCAS system, the collision avoidance system, right, will suddenly ping, and it's like a 200 baud system, right? And the two planes communicate with each other automatically and make a decision, and so one pilot, let's say this pilot here, gets this terrifying message, pull up, right? And the other one gets the message, descend. And so hopefully this happened, right? So the problem is that if you divert your course, when you land at your destination airport, you have to fill out a lot of paperwork, okay? And so you're coming in, you hear this message, pull up. And you know the other guy's gonna get the message, descend. And you're like, aha. Right? So you think that person's at level zero and you're at level one and you can skip this, right? See what's going to happen here, right? And so in fact, this is amazing, right? Pilots ignore the TCAS system, okay? And so they're somewhere between sort of level one and level zero, okay? So this is a bit theoretical, but in fact, it's one of the secrets to the power of social media. We used to think the like button was a way to kind of produce a crowdsource, is this good or is this bad? At least that's how it was in the late 90s, early 2000s, right? You either said awesome or dislike, high, you know, upvote or downvote. Facebook's genius was to not have a dislike button, just to have a thumbs up. Because what the thumbs up does is it doesn't tell you whether you've done something good or something bad, it tells you that somebody's seen you. Same thing with comments, right? So here's a friend of mine, Justin. He's like, I'm hiking with my wonderful family, right? And then Sora writes this comment. And so now Justin knows that Sora saw it. He goes to Facebook. He's like, aha, I know that she knows something. But of course, Sora's in this kind of problem. She's in this problem space because, you know, she's done this, but she doesn't know if Justin's seen it. But Justin, of course, can click the like button, and now Sora knows that Justin knows that Sora saw it. So in practice, how do we achieve common knowledge in the modern era? It's just about the same as we've done it for the last 700 or 2,000 years, which is we come in person, right? I'm speaking very loudly. You know that I'm speaking loudly. You know that I'm speaking loudly enough to be heard. And then you, therefore, you know not only what I'm saying, but you know that other people know what I'm saying. The laptops ruin this a little bit, which is one of the reasons why when we teach, we hate them. This is a picture of a kiva. This is a system of governance near the Santa Fe Institute. It used to be the ancestral peoples who lived in this part of the world built these round, sort of, they're essentially seminar rooms. And people just sit around the rim here and discuss what to do. And the nice thing about sitting in a circle is it's really easy to see everybody and for everybody to see you seeing everybody and all the way up. So this is a common knowledge machine. So the scientists have their kivas. This is where we began when we started building research collaborations, when we started trying to do something as scientists. One of the first ones is the Royal Society of London, right? This is the scientists' kiva. Right? This is one of the first places that people who were sort of independent seekers, people who just were essentially the nerds of the 17th century, began to produce some kind of collective body that did all the things we want collective bodies to do. It told people what the norms were. It told them what they could expect from others. It told others the kinds of things people were interested in, like magnetism is big, like that's the new ADS-CFT. Right, and I think there's some connection between electricity and magnetism. So this was, this is near Pall Mall. It's a beautiful place. This is their crest. Interestingly, they got to have this is the helmet on the crest. They got to have a royal crest for some reason. So those bars there are associated with royalty. Their motto, and this will become important, their motto is Nullius in Verba. Does anybody speak Latin?
Don't take anybody's word for it.
Exactly, it's the show me state, right? Part of the goal here was to get beyond the kind of secrecy that we associate with, let's say, the Newton-Leibniz battles, right? Where people would, in fact, discover something, then turn it into a cryptogram and only publish the cryptogram so they could establish priority without anybody actually seeing it. It would be like me writing a paper, then producing the, you know, MD5 hash and only sending out the hash, right? So the origins of the Royal Society can be found in something called the Republic of Letters, a far more decentralized system. Stanford and actually Carnegie Mellon have mapped the 17th and 18th century world where scientists and philosophers communicated by writing letters to each other. And this network extends, network here is focused largely on Ireland, England, Scotland, that's the Scottish Enlightenment up there, Paris, and then with these long-range connections across the world, and you can see a couple ones going out to, you know, Ben Franklin, and a couple here, that's probably the Kant's, right? So the origins, you know, people didn't sit in big rooms together. In fact, they wrote letters to each other. This is the precursor. And in fact, there was a set of social norms associated with this. And one of the nice norm-based, or one of the nice social norms was, in fact, you have to write back, right? If, you know, Pascal writes you a letter, you're morally obligated, it would be a dereliction of duty not to write him back. Of course, there is also a duty to copy letters and pass them along. The other thing that you'll find here, and this is in some sense something that we'll see when we look into the 21st century, is that what matters is reputation, not prestige. It doesn't matter what your academic position is. Many people didn't, of course, have one at the time. What matters is the reputation you built through your correspondence within this system. The Royal Society is partly the formalization or the institutionalization of this kind of work. It's also a fantasy. It's a fantasy based on a book by a man called Francis Bacon, who you might think of as the founding father of experimental or empirical science, something that we had a trouble doing, right? Actually seeing what was happening in the world was something that Aristotle didn't really like to do. Bacon wrote a book called The New Atlantis, which is sort of like if you ever read Ananthem by Neal Stephenson. The New Atlantis is this fantasy, essentially, of a perimeter institute sitting off, not in Ontario, but on a special little island. It's called Solomon's House, and somebody gets shipwrecked there, and they discover, you know, they're postdocs. It's a wonderful thing, right? And so the Royal Society was a combination of a set of norms with a fantasy. Okay. So what happens after the Royal Society? Eventually, things like these big buildings, these big kivas that we sit around in and discuss and decide what science is going to be, that disappeared at some point. What came next is sort of, this is sort of the long dark ages, right? The era of the mega journal, okay? This is the old joke, right? Just because it's in Science or Nature, it doesn't mean it's wrong, okay? What the mega journal does is it enables us to learn what other scientists are doing without going to London. And of course, the reason that we publish in Nature and Science or PNAS is not just because, you know, we want other people to see it, but we kind of know these are shelling points, right? We know that other people are reading Nature and Science. So if, you know, somebody says, oh, you know, so-and-so has a paper in Nature, okay, we know that other people are going to see it. In fact, even if we don't read it. So when something appears in the tables of contents here, we get common knowledge. We know that other people know. And that means, for example, if we start to adapt our research projects after what comes here, we can largely expect that others will follow suit, okay? Obviously, we don't like this era, right? Particularly not Nature and Science, in part because these are very strongly controlled by the editors as opposed to scientists. Like, a friend of mine is right now trying to kill a paper by a famous behavioral economist, and it's very hard, okay? He's one of the supposed peer reviewers. So we can make fun of these two eras, but we learned a lot from them. They did a great deal for science, not just as common knowledge machines. The Royal Society probably did two major things. One is, of course, the idea that you should share your results. You couldn't keep them secret. There was something more important than priority, something more important than just proving how smart you were. And the other was bringing this Baconian skepticism, take no one's word for it, into the basis of the kinds of sharing that went on. So there's this legend, I've never been able to actually demonstrate it or find the historical evidence for this. Sometimes we use the first person plural when we write scientific papers. We say, you know, we did this even if there's only one author. One of the reasons is not that you imagine yourself to be the royal we, but you imagine the reader as in a collaboration with you, right? So we do this, we do that. It's you and the reader. The mega journal did a couple things. In fact, one thing we don't remember is that at some point in time, as great as the Royal Society was in the 17th century, by the 18th century and certainly by the 19th century, it had completely collapsed as an effective institution. It had filled up, you know, it was sort of like the donors ended up being the postdocs, okay? And so some people, certainly by the middle of the 19th century, people like Charles Babbage, William Whewell, some of the great British scientists of that era, had realized that there were basically no scientific standards in the Royal Society before, now, that the things that were appearing in philosophical transactions were often diary entries. And so Nature, Science, PNAS, these are journals that come out of the desire to make the doing of science answerable to a larger community. Peer review is not part of this, really. Peer review is actually incredibly recent. Nature switched over to peer review in 1967. Most journals before 1950 didn't really do this. It's actually an incredibly recent innovation. You see it from time to time. In fact, there was probably peer review happening in the 17th century, in the late 1600s, in the philosophical transactions. But the widespread use of it is really a mid-20th century phenomenon. So have we gotten beyond step one and step two? Well, one answer, of course, is this new source of common knowledge that we have, the preprint server. Certainly physicists, many of us, or certainly when I was in physics, the preprint server, the new articles list was my homepage. It may be true if you're a physicist, but that's where you look. You don't look at the table of contents for physical review. This is where things come up that matter. This is a wonderful website here, which lists all of the either morning or weekly discussion groups around what was on the archive that morning. And there's on the order of 400 of them. So I know that if I put something on the preprint server, the next morning, everybody will be looking at it, and everybody knows that everybody will be looking at it, and so on down the line. It's a new common knowledge engine, and we get a lot of things, we get a lot of things that we didn't get before. It's fast, you can put things up. It's transparent, multiple versions are kept. It enables, these two things here, enables papers to be in dialogue with each other, and I'll show you an example of that in a moment. The archive, like many of the systems that we'll talk about, it's one of these, it works in practice, not in theory. It shouldn't work, And that's maybe a warning sign for us as we come to write down what we think we want to happen. You can't really reverse it. Here's all the things that could go wrong, right? First of all, it could just be kind of a junk pile where people just throw out stuff. But in fact, the archive is taken seriously. You don't want to have something wrong, badly formatted, incoherent on the archive. There are norms of excellence. People feel obligated to correct errors. People feel obligated to update papers. Interestingly, the biologists have kind of missed this. The preprint server for biology run out of Cold Spring Harbor doesn't allow you to update preprints, for example, after you publish. And there's some, we got into a battle over that one. Okay. There's priority norms, which is really interesting, right? If you put a paper on the archive to establish your results, even if it's not peer-reviewed, if people see it, there's a general norm that if you cite that result, you should cite the archive paper, and then when that gets published, you update it to the final peer-reviewed version. But putting it up on the archive, even though it hasn't gone through publication, is for many of us a norm. We acknowledge the norm of acknowledging that person, at least as a co-originator of the idea. Okay. Finally, archive is surprisingly crank-free. It's really remarkable. And it's not quite clear how they do it. One thing is just you need a .edu email address, or you used to. There's a little bit of vouching. I had to vouch for a grad student once. And there's a little bit of kind of behind the scenes tweaking that no one really talks about. But in fact, this is a pretty light load. Here's an example of the archive norms in action. I won't talk about cranks, but I'll talk about this, the BICEP 2 results. This was an experiment down at the South Pole that in an archive paper and a little bit press release, they claimed to have discovered a signal of B-modes, which were themselves a signal of gravitational waves that came from the early universe. This created an enormous amount of media sensation. So this is another thing we'll see, right? New institutions like the archive depend in part on old institutions like science and nature, right? My old advisor, who was, of course, a cosmologist, David Spergel, as soon as this came out, he was like, this is not true. This is not true. We know probably what's happened. They had dust. There's an intervening interference between what should have been the signal coming from the early universe that has generated this by accident, and a whole bunch of papers piled out onto the archive, right? Nobody was waiting for peer review to have this dialogue in action. And in fact, one of the norms, you can see there's three versions here. I'm showing you the final version. The first version was much stronger than the final version. Although these guys never really said, okay, you're right, we blew it, right? Which they should have said. And just here's two, actually, these are both from two old advisors, Mayim Rich God and David Spergel. So that's an example of norms in practice. So one way to think about where we are trying to get is This is what we call a 2x2 grid. What we're trying to do is get common knowledge. In small groups, we know how to do it, and we also know how to do it either in an authoritarian fashion or a decentralized fashion. Right now, I'm giving you common knowledge. We're generating common knowledge about what I've seen. It's a kind of classroom style. It's hard for you to speak back, although if you want to argue, please do. We can do common knowledge in a decentralized case. We'll do that in the brainstorming session. So we'll all sit around a circle. We'll make suggestions. Even if my suggestion is not taken up, I know it's not because I wasn't heard. I know it's because everybody heard what I heard, and no one really liked it. It's very different from sending an email. We know how to do large authoritarian common knowledge. The Royal Society is an example of that. Nature and science is an example. That may be archive. It's hard to know where to put this because we get excited about this chunk of common knowledge right here, not just the archive in the 21st century, but also the Republic of Letters back in the 17th and 18th century. So how do we get to this fourth square? Right? Where are we going on this journey, right, from 1660 to 2018? Well, one way to understand what could happen is to look at a similar transition in a different regime, which is the transition from the Encyclopedia Britannica to Wikipedia. Wikipedia is an engine for producing common knowledge. And I'll talk first about within-system common knowledge. You have people working on Wikipedia. They have ideas. They want to know. They want to do something. They want also to know what other people want to do. And they also want, of course, other people to know what other people are going to do, and all the way up that tower. One way they did that was the power of the sentence. Wikipedia is the encyclopedia that everybody can edit. Sentences, one sentence is really great for common knowledge because you can basically figure out that if that sentence is sitting somewhere on the front page, it's really short. And everybody probably saw it. And they can reason the same way. If this was, you know, at 25 pages, right, who's going to read that? You have no idea which bits people saw. But the power of one sentence, a well-constructed sentence for producing common knowledge is hard to underestimate. Let's just take this apart. We'll do a close reading of the encyclopedia that everybody can edit. Okay, the word encyclopedia is a specific fantasy. It's a generative fantasy, but we kind of know what encyclopedias do, and so it's easy for us to write a list of things that Wikipedia is not. Encyclopedias are sort of funny things. We think we know what they are, but actually they've changed over the years. What it means to be an encyclopedia, people have different ideas, but at least they all know that they're trying to produce something that looks like something that they've seen before. Okay. There was a sort of competitor to Wikipedia called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, similar kind of style. The problem with The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is nobody knows what's in it. Nobody knows what the entry should look like because we only had a couple fragments from Douglas Adams' stories. So this failed in part because people got there and they may have an idea of what to do, but they didn't know what other people thought was going on. There's a fundamental confusion at the heart of that project where there wasn't, simply because there was this orienting image. Here's the other part of the sentence. The encyclopedia that everyone can edit. So this is what we might call the without which nothing norm. There's a single norm at the heart of all of this. Everybody can edit Wikipedia, and that enabled us to achieve common knowledge about the kinds of solutions that were and were not admissible to the problems that emerge. And the basic story is that there were no top-down solutions allowed, particularly in the creation of content. There were no committees of review, there were no specialist editors, there were no curators of a page. There was nobody, let's say, who owned a page who was in charge of deciding what did or did not go in. These kinds of very specialized or much more specific norms came out of the fact they were people could build them in part because they knew that everybody had seen this sentence, everybody presumably consented to it, and this was part of the sentence. Now, building an encyclopedia is another thing that works in practice, not in theory, right? Building an encyclopedia that everybody could edit shouldn't work. What they had to do in the end was start producing an enormous number of norms. So when you get on Wikipedia and start editing, people say, well, you have to be civil to each other, right? You have to work by consensus. And what consensus means, it's tricky, of course, right? You have to, don't get into edit wars on Wikipedia. Don't battle each other to the death, right? Stay cool when things get hot, right? Wikipedia is not about winning, right? Okay. Arguments to avoid. So all of these norms here, all of these things that you ought to do on the encyclopedia, people could produce and come to agreement on in part because they had common knowledge about the fundamental principle. Right? Once they built norms, it's sort of fun. We did some work. This is my research. We did some work on this, and we looked at how these norms started to link together. People wrote a page about how you ought to do things. Other people wrote other pages interpreting it and linked together. Right? And so, you know, here's a norm about, you know, the article should be neutral. They shouldn't take political positions. Here's a norm that arose out of neutrality, which is how do you figure out if you're being neutral? Here's a problem with neutrality, and then these things link further and further out, and then in fact you get out all the way over here to naming conventions, which you say, what does that have to do with neutrality? And of course then you say, well, okay, what do you call the Palestinian state? What do you call Londonderry? Is it Derry or Londonderry in Northern Ireland? This might remind you, there's the West Bank. This might remind you of something very ancient. Many of the problems we've solved before, might remind you, if you're Jewish, of the Talmud, right? Where there's a text in the middle and there's all the interpretations around it. They didn't have web links back in the day. Okay. In fact, the norm system is so large, there's about 2,000 of them now, okay? And you can see them kind of separating out. Each of these nodes is a story about something you ought or ought not to do. I'm going to skip this. This is one of the things that we've discovered in studying Wikipedia is that while certain kinds of conflict are normally prohibited, in fact, conflict is a fundamental feature of this system. Wikipedia allowed for conflict, and as far as we can tell, the allowance for conflict enabled the system to develop over time. In fact, it was a key part of injecting new material into the page. If you eliminate conflict, we believe, you also eliminate the dynamism. And this is here, I'll just read this graph to you in a very simple fashion. This is sort of your distance in time from a point of serious conflict. On the y-axis here is a measure of the surprise from one version of the page to the next, meaning to what extent does the new version of the page differ from the previous one. And what you can see is near a conflict point, the page is actually changing very quickly. It was a surprise to us. So that's the first thing that Wikipedia allowed, or the first thing that Wikipedia discovered was that you need to have norms. These norms can be generated from a seed norm, which is that everybody can edit it. There's another genius part of Wikipedia, and I call this low algorithmic determinism, right? There's basically one thing you do on Wikipedia, take a page and edit it. Right? If you want to edit the page on general relativity, you click a button, edit, and this is what it looks like. If you want to edit someone's user talk page, this is how users communicate with you, this is how you leave messages for people. It's exactly the same interface. So one thing to think about, right, they didn't do anything you ought to do, right? They didn't have like threaded discussions like comment trees. They didn't have up-down ratings, like buttons. They didn't have private messaging. They had no distinctions between the different kinds of things you could do. There was just one thing you could do. And that simplicity, I think, also enabled the formation of common knowledge. Because if I want to communicate with Mateo, and there's like eight different ways I can do it, and some of them are really hard to do, they might give me some advantages, but I don't know if he knows them, then I'm frustrated in my ability to get something done with him. If there's a simple way to do it, I know that everybody knows that everybody knows that we can. The final thing that that I think Wikipedia benefited from was it was highly evolvable. As problems came up, they were able to dynamically adjust what they were doing in response. So I talked about cranks on the archive. The way the archive saw is that Paul Ginsberg effectively develops new things on his own to prevent the system from being overwhelmed by, you know, dynamic magnetic field theories of cosmology or the plasma universe. Here's the sort of unfolding on the mailing list as Jimmy Wales sort of discovered this problem. People were sort of writing back and forth. I don't know if these are meaningful. And the first thing, these are sort of strange plasma cosmology, dynamic theory of gravity. These are sort of crank-like theories that only one or two people promote. And the first thing they thought was that norms that were already in place, in fact, the norm on neutrality would be sufficient to solve the crackpot problem. That if you would have a crackpot article, you'd present it in a neutral fashion, meaning that you'd also present the counter evidence and the fact that it was ignored. Over time, they figure out, you know what, like, okay, sort of this is a couple months later, you know, I think this is a challenge. I don't think that that particular norm could solve it. And then finally, what they did was they invented a new norm that was called no original research. Here it is. So that wasn't there at the beginning. Nobody thought they would need it. As this problem arose, they thought the norms they had previously would enable them to solve the problem. That neutrality norm, they realized that the neutrality norm couldn't work, and this new norm entered the system. So there are sort of three lessons, I think, that we can take from Wikipedia, the things that enabled it to beat the old top-down encyclopedia world. You got people on the same page, but not the same paragraph, and you did that with a very simple motto. This is like nullius in verba. What are we doing at the Royal Society? You know, who's the king of the Royal Society? How does the journal? No one cares. Take no one's word for it. That's the rule. We know what to expect, and we know what others should expect us to do. And we know that if someone doesn't do it, it's not because that's what we're doing. It's the fact they broke the rule. Okay. The other thing that worked, right, was through this norm system, they enabled people through this here. They built a system that depended upon reputation, not status. Nobody said this person was qualified to do that. The norms themselves allowed people to work out what to do. And finally, the system was ad hoc, not a priori. No one sat down and worked out all the things that had to go into building an encyclopedia. What they did was they had a system that was sufficiently flexible. It enabled them to dynamically adjust over time. People called this the ad hocracy. So that's how people work together within the system. The other question we have is, of course, how did they work? How did they produce common knowledge in the wider world? People working on Wikipedia were able to know that other people shared the values of that system, shared the goals. But how did they become common knowledge outside? How do they actually impact the world? How do they get beyond system common knowledge? How do they get famous? There's one answer, which is that by accident, the way Wikipedia articles link to each other was catnip for Google's algorithm. It still is today. You type basically any common noun into Google, out the other side, near the top will come the Wikipedia article for it. It's common as salt. And so, of course, when you do this, when you type this in, you know that other people will get the same thing. So if there's something stupid about general relativity on Wikipedia, you're motivated to go fix it because you know that's actually what other people are looking at. The other thing, of course, is if you type in sodium chloride, you type in something simple into Google and you get that Wikipedia article about it, you're probably going to link to it yourself on your blog or whatever. And that, of course, just makes it stronger. So there's this sort of virtuous cycle. Wikipedia took over Google search results, again, entirely by accident. If Google had somehow tweaked this, Wikipedia probably would have not achieved the kind of dominance it did. So that's one thing that happened. One institution outside gave it power. The other thing is, in fact, one of the old institutions helped, Nature. So Nature produced this special report in 2005, the end of 2005, produced this special report. And in fact, what they did was they peer-reviewed Wikipedia comparatively with the Encyclopedia Britannica and found that it had essentially the same level of accuracy. So one of the things that you find is while you have dynamic, inventive, internal systems for establishing within system common knowledge, the way you get famous, I hate to say it, right, is the old institutions make you famous, okay? They're always gatekeepers. In fact, they tend to work. Google survives on the ability to give people what they want, and in the end, they wanted Wikipedia. The press survives on the ability to find the new. What I would say that means is don't worry about prestige, don't worry about fame. You're not going to be able to tweak, you're not going to be able to, you know, buy off Google or convince someone at Google to give you press. You're not going to be able to talk Nature into it, certainly. Why is beyond system common knowledge matter at all? Why can't we just live on our island, our perimeter in the ocean? Just focus on the blue line here, which is the population of Wikipedia over time. In fact, most of the dynamism, the creation of institutional structures, the creation of norms, happened when the system was essentially 5 or 10% of the peak population. It happened here between 2001 and 2005. At the end of 2005, that's where the Nature article is, and you can see that's where the system takes off. Okay? So a lot of the work was done secretly, or not secretly, but a lot of work was done when nobody was looking at Wikipedia. So, okay, what are our lessons from the past? One thing is mottos matter, not constitutions, not 20-page or even 3-page or even 1-page statements of purpose, right? Just put it in a sentence. Because if you have a sentence, then everybody can know what that sentence is. Take no one's word for it. It helps if you have some fancy graphic, apparently. Right? Take no one's word for it. The encyclopedia that everyone can edit. This is a terrible tagline, the free encyclopedia. What does that mean? Does that mean, you know, free as in open source? Or does that mean free as in, like, I can edit it? This is a terrible line. Fortunately, this line was not sitting around back when the actual work was getting done. So that's lesson one, mottos matter. Okay. Lesson two is norms matter, not rules. It wasn't like there was back in the creation of the Republic of Letters and people writing back and forth to each other. It wasn't that the king, right, or the, you know, the revolutionary government of Paris sort of told everybody what the rules were, and if someone, you know, didn't reply, then they didn't get a job or something, right? These were emergent ideas about what you ought to do. It's hard to say where they originated, but they took over the system. Similarly here, right, it's not like Paul Ginsberg, the person who was developing the archive, rang up, you know, Neil Turok and was like, look, you shouldn't promote people who blow off the archive. Somehow, the norm of putting results out, other people writing back in response, taking this seriously, getting mad if somebody put something wrong up on the archive and writing a counterpiece, that norm emerged from somewhere. It was not a rule laid down. And Wikipedia is one of the great examples of how these norms, in fact, proliferated. There's 2,000 pages describing what you ought or ought not to do and interpreting that. This, in fact, works much better than if you had some contract or constitution that was written ahead of time. If you freeze in a system early because you've produced the Port Huron Declaration of Open Science, you're not going to be able to adjust to the completely unexpected things that happen. This is a third lesson from the past, okay, which is, let me say, fantasies matter, myths matter. The Royal Society, in part, was the actualization of a myth produced a few decades earlier by Francis Bacon, a sort of a world of nerds devoted to the common good, speaking with each other and figuring out what to do. There's a myth behind Nature. It's one of the reasons we all publish, and I don't, but the reason biologists want to publish in Nature, there's this great myth with Crick and Watson, where they publish the structure of DNA. It's actually hidden behind there. They also, you know, suggest that they, at the end of this article, they also suggest that this is an information-carrying object, right? So Crick and Watson, they walk into the Eagle Pub and say, you know, good morning, it's lunchtime at the Eagle Pub. They say, we've discovered the secret of life. Where do they publish this? They publish it in Nature. So every biologist, I think, secretly thinks they're going to discover DNA, and if they do, they'll put it there. So these myths are part of how the system works, part of how they understand themselves. Notice that the Nature myth, that something amazing will come out that you don't expect, that's a myth that sits there today. We know that if we have a wonderful result, that's where we should put it. So I talked about this fourth square. I talked about the importance of common knowledge and a way in which we can generate it. The problem is, how do we generate it in a decentralized and large-scale fashion? How do we change how research is done? How do we change how collaboration is done? So I have three possibilities. I'm not going to tell you really what they are, but I'm going to see if I can get you excited by them just, okay, by their motto, their myth, and the norms that sit there. So we'll call the first one the data mist. Here's the motto. Obviously, you want it in Latin. All knowledge is one. The myth is the colleague down the hall. And the norms are metadata, reliability, and trust. So you tell me if you can figure out what to do if somebody gave you those three things. What is that about? If you don't know, that's because we've blown it in one of these three things, personal opinion. Second one is the blockchain republic. The motto is save everything. The myth is the lost archive. The norms, completeness, iteration, validation, forgiveness. Different set of norms, different myth, different motto. Finally, there's the moonshot, and again, you tell me if this makes sense. You tell me if you know what you know what you would do or know what you would try and do if you showed up on the system or someone told you about it. The motto, falsify or integrate. The myth, Asimov's foundation. Okay. The norms, collaboration, ambition, and demo or die. I think all of these have to have the sort of without which nothing norms, reputation, not prestige, priority and citation, ad hocery, right? But maybe we can figure out if I'm right by telling me if you know what to do given those three things. There's one thing, last one thing I want to say, which is I think the origins of this, right, if any of these things get working or anything, these things that we built that we talk about in the next 2 days get working, my guess is that the graduate students will be the ones that are driving it. There's a couple reasons you want grad students to do this. First of all, grads, they're pains in the ass. They won't do what they're told, okay? They won't just do what you're doing as a scientist. They always disobey. The other thing that's nice is that grad students at high prestige institutions, and we have to rely on the past in order to build the future. We can't say that Google doesn't matter, that Nature doesn't matter for Wikipedia, right? We rely on that. You know, who's more arrogant than a UChicago graduate student? Okay? Those are the people who will potentially build things that we haven't seen before, will do things that adult scientists won't. So I wonder if we can make whatever we do appeal to the people who sit around and, you know, they come in and they're like, well, I did this thing. Oh, don't do that. You can skip that bit. Okay. I wonder if those people will drive the adoption of these systems in the future. So I don't know if I have any more time. Do I have any more time, or shall we pause there? I have a video up otherwise.
Yes,
Sorry?
Could you?
Yes, of course. Yeah. Questions, yeah.
Could you expand on the moonshot a little bit? It kind of flew by me.
Here's my trick, right? I'm not going to tell you what it, I mean, I can tell you what my idea is, right? The motto is falsify or integrate. The myth is Asimov's foundation. So here's a thought, right? What if, okay, we have all, let's take social science for an example, right? What if we have a bunch of people doing different kinds of social science? They're doing, you know, network structures of collaboration online. They're doing psychological studies of altruism in the lab. They're doing econometric studies where you have some kind of natural experiment. Well, if we're right, then presumably the theory built in one domain should extend or fit with a theory or a result built in another domain. If the psychologists tell us that people are naturally altruistic under some set of circumstances, and then we find that set of circumstances established in a social network that we've studied in a completely different way, in a completely different discipline, then one of two things could happen. The two results could integrate, they could be consistent with each other, or they could clash. One could falsify the other. So the myth, so that's the motto, falsify or integrate. You have two results. One of them is wrong. Otherwise, they fit together. Okay, it's a, not entirely what could happen, but your mottos have to be short. The myth is Asimov's foundation, the grand theory of everything that's built in the in that case in a science fiction story over the course of a few books, right? And the norms are collaboration. You have to work together, obviously. The norms are ambition. It's incredibly ambitious to try and link two theories in very different domains. And I think another norm has to be demo or die, meaning that you actually have to show you've either done it or not done it. So that's just a suggestion.
Are we taking questions now, Mateo?
Yeah, I mean, ask as you like. Yeah.
How long is the video?
Let me just plug in the sound. It's like 2-3 minutes.
Yeah, that's how the video.
Yeah, so this is a little bit of a sort of test your knowledge thing. It's a moment of creation of common knowledge. And the video itself, like the creation and dissemination of this video was itself an act of common knowledge. People saw this and knew that everybody else was seeing it. And in the video itself, you'll see a battle of one form of common knowledge against the other. So here we go. Right, hang on. Oh, is it? Oh, hang on. I'm going to play the sound here. Do you know?
The sound goes to the...
Oh, it does.
Monotonous time in all history. A garden of pure ideology where each worker may bloom, secure from the pests of a contradictory force. The flagship of force is more powerful a weapon than any fleet or army on earth. We are one people, with one will, one resolve, one cause. Our enemies shall talk themselves to death, and we will bury them with their own confusion. We shall prevail.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
Any questions?
Have two.
Would you like to run or should I just pick?
Sure.
Okay, please, go ahead, yeah.
The first is just a comment. Just showing my age, I was watching everyone looking at the video, which in my world, it's just a common part of our history.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. With regards to your presentation, fantastic, particularly for the main thing, you haven't told me anything new. You just give me a structure of a number of things that makes sense, and that's the beauty of it. Now, I wonder what happened between Newton and Leibniz today. The calculus wars, Newton put all the prestige, and the poor Leibniz was, I don't know, destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Can you please imagine what would happen in the Wikipedia world?
We've certainly seen this. Let me talk about the archive briefly, and then we'll talk about Wikipedia. So, you know, every good idea was invented a couple times, right? So, you know, who invented inflation? Was it Steve Weinberg, right? In fact, if you look in the record, in roughly 2 or 3 years around that point, in part because of the frustrations of the Soviet Union, it was probably invented a couple times over. Somehow Steve got the credit for it. I don't think he would say he was the only, I mean, it's not somebody who tried to. It's not like Newton versus Leibniz. There, the system, I think it did two things. One is that was sort of the pre-archive era, so we didn't know, right, the extent to which this discovery could be made multiply. Weinberg was in the right place. He was at a, he was at an institution that could generate common knowledge very easily. So that's a parallel story. I think today, if that kind of thing happened, you would have the archive, right? People would be uploading things to the archive as they happen, and so it'd be much easier to resolve those disputes. Of course, you know, the Newton versus Leibniz battle was not a good thing for science.
It was power versus reality.
The other thing I think is, I mean, what would happen on Wikipedia? Wikipedia has a, you know, there's a norm that says this doesn't matter. So there's a norm that says if you create something on Wikipedia, you give it away. You can't take credit for something. You don't own it. One of the ways you see this norm in action is that people use pseudonyms. Certainly in the early days, there was a norm against using your real name, and there was certainly a norm against putting underscore PhD or doctor in front or at the end. There was a norm against any kind of hierarchy, and not only that, there was a norm against taking credit for things. Yes, and then we'll go to the back, yes.
It struck me in some of your examples that irrationality seemed crucial to enable cooperation.
Okay.
At least if irrationality is defined as narrow economic self-interest. But I'm wondering, are there certain kinds of characteristic irrationalities that you see in the scientific community that could be leveraged somehow?
I wouldn't call it irrational to do something for reasons other than economic self-interest. We tend to speak that way because that's the only predictive theory we have about how people ought to behave. It's also a predictive theory that's constantly disproven. So we want to give things away. We would spend a lot of money in order to be known for something, even if we had no benefit for it. Right. If you would tell me that, the day after you died, you would be recognized as the founder of a field, you would be very happy, even though there was not in your self-interest at all. So what are the irrationalities? I think there's a great deal of consistency from here down to here. No, that's all right. That's all right. I think there's a great deal of consistency in how people work. I think one of the things we'd like to do is we'd like to do things together. That's why we come to meetings. That's why we sit around the table. And I think that's a desire we have that can't be reduced down. Maybe we call it irrational, and so maybe the thing we want to leverage is the Republic of Letters in the 21st century. There was a question in the back, and then you should tell me. Yeah. Great.
The first one, I just forgot. I'm sorry. What, could you remind us of the without which nothing norm? What is that?
Everybody can edit. That's the norm from which you derive or expand upon to get everything else. Yeah.
And then maybe more interesting, I mean, if you look at various proposals people have had for open science tools, which ones in particular do you think would be held back or might be held back by common knowledge issues?
Any system that involves uploading data and making it usable by others. It takes a lot of work. It's very risky to upload data. It takes a lot of work to figure out how to make it usable by others. If you don't expect other people to do it, then it's much harder to motivate yourself to do it. It's very hard to, ask a graduate student to do it. It's certainly also very hard to imagine that other people will as well. I think the systems that get that rolling, I think one of the reasons that they've stalled out is because of an inability to form common knowledge. My sense is that it will have to begin much smaller in the same way Wikipedia did. Thank you very much. I appreciate your questions.